Hi, my name is Doug Phillips. I'd like to welcome you to the second podcast from the American Journal of Neuroradiology. We were very heartened and excited about the response to the inaugural podcast. Those of you who downloaded that podcast were treated to a group discussion on CT perfusion, notably the discussion of dosing during CT perfusion and the overall utility of the examination technique. This month, we will be reviewing some journal club choices from the American Journal of Neuroradiology's current issue, both articles selected from the Fellows Journal Club as well as by the senior editors of the American Journal of Neuroradiology. The first article selected from the Fellows Journal Club is by Galas et al., a long-term follow-up of 1,036 cerebral aneurysms treated by bare coils, a multicentric cohort treated between 1998 and 2003. We can expect to see many papers of this style becoming available within the next few years. This paper, as I am sure many others to follow, represent the long-term results of endovascular treatment of intracranial aneurysms. We now have good equivalency results in multiple studies of endovascular therapy versus traditional operative placement of clips for intracranial aneurysms. Now we're finally gaining some data as to the long-term outcomes of patients who were treated in endovascular fashions at multiple centers. This study is a large study from France and concerns a cohort of patients treated between 5 and 10 years ago with bare platinum coils, the Guglielmi detachable coils that were the first marketed coils for endovascular therapy. These patients were followed annually with MR imaging as well as repeat catheter digital subtraction angiography to follow the course of their coiled aneurysms. Bare platinum coils, of course, were the initial technology available for coil obliteration of aneurysms. This technique followed some early experience with intraaneurysmal balloon occlusion as well as parent artery occlusions, which was performed for some period of time. The results of this 5-center trial were actually quite good. After the initial treatment, complete occlusion was demonstrated in slightly more than 70% of patients, subtotal occlusion in approximately 24% of patients, incomplete occlusion in 2%, and an overall failure of occlusion in 3%. This led to a second procedure in 72 of the original 1,063 aneurysms, representing 7% of the treatment group. Retreatment was due to an initial incomplete occlusion, or as in some cases, to later recanalization. Fewer than 5 of the patients in this series rebled during the 10-year follow-up period. As has been imagined, retreatment is not common, and even in the face of incomplete occlusions at initial treatment, the rate of rebleeding in this patient group is very small. This is an important determinant of patient's outcome, the incidence of rebleeding. We are all fairly certain that we can look forward to many more of these long-term results papers that should appear in the literature over the next few years. And perhaps we will learn more of the potential differences between coil technologies that were introduced subsequent to the bare Guglielmi detachable coils, such as coated or chemically otherwise treated coils that were incorporated into many practices in a wide fashion. Speaking this afternoon with Dr. Howard Ryan, Associate Professor of Neurosurgery at Weill Cornell Medical College at the New York Presbyterian Hospital. Howard, just wanted to get your opinion about this large published series now of the obliteration rates with bare platinum coils. Just a few opinions, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, we've been working with detachable coils for about 18 years now. And the original coil technology was bare platinum coil technology. And we had some initial very, very promising results. And it was only natural that at some point we would be dealing with a surface modified type of coil. And several coils were introduced, including the Matrix coil from Boston Scientific, which was a PGLA coated coil, and also more recently, the hydrocoil type of technology. Both of these technologies were used with the theory that there would be a greater obliteration of the aneurysm by causing a more rapid thrombosis and a more tight packing of the aneurysm dome. However, with the techniques such as balloon remodeling, we've been able to achieve very tight packing with pure platinum as well. So with pure platinum and the balloon remodeling technique, you can densely pack the aneurysm dome, and as this study clearly demonstrates, have excellent long-term results. So the question really is what is the role of the surface-modified coils, and can their extra expense justify their use? And I think these types of studies that are coming out now, where people are using bare platinum technologies and trying to achieve a denser packing density within the dome, are clearly demonstrating that maybe we don't need to use the surface modified coils to the same degree that people had anticipated earlier.
So Howard, do you think it's fair to say that we're just going to be waiting for some more of these large multi-center longitudinal trials before we can really get a good answer, or do you think that there's a reasonable answer there now?
Well, most of the clinicians that I know, and I can say from my own practices, the vast majority of aneurysms we will treat with bare platinum. If we have some recurrence at the neck, or we're concerned about some open and patent areas when we're done coiling an aneurysm, then maybe we'll use a surface modified coil in that area, such as a hydrogel type of coil. I think that in general, the new focus in area is for flow diversion or flow modification, and I think that's what we're seeing more of in the future. But as far as coil technology, many people have gone back to pure platinum, and as this study demonstrates, with great results.
Thank you, Howard.
The second journal choice from the Fellows Journal Club is an article by Hibotashi et al. Entitled, Subsequent Fracture After Percutaneous Vertebroplasty Can Be Predicted on Preoperative Multi-Detector Row CT. Practitioners of vertebroplasty as well as kyphoplasty know this story well. You perform a vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty, and in a few months the patient develops another painful fracture in an adjacent vertebra. For practitioners of vertebroplasty, as well as all spine imagers, it would certainly be nice to know what vertebra are prone to these subsequent fractures. In this paper, the authors prospectively evaluated 26 patients with 58 fractured vertebrae using CT multiplanar reformations one day pre-procedure. In those patients who had recurrent pain at least 3 months after the initial treatment, spine MR imaging was performed. New fractures had occurred in 28 vertebrae, 14 adjacent to the treated one, and 14 at a level remote to the treated vertebral level. Risk factors determined by the authors include the use of steroid medications and, interestingly, a low CT attenuation value of the adjacent vertebral bodies. Further collapse of the treated vertebrae is also documented in 10 additional papers. This paper is accompanied in the current journal by an editorial point and counterpoint on the widely quoted sham studies for vertebroplasty that had appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine a few months back. These two editorials are thought-provoking and are widely recommended to the readership. Evidence-based medicine has obviously become the holy grail of governing bodies of medical reimbursement. Studies which indicate either no utility or efficacy of your technique, whatever it be, when these studies are done in a rigorous and scientific method, will likely point your techniques towards an eventual failure of reimbursement. The difficulty that many see might be in the definition that you apply to the efficacy that you care to demonstrate. If pain control is the efficacy, you have to study for pain control. If spine stabilization is the efficacy, you direct your study to determine spine stability. Where do we stand in this discourse now? I am sure, absolutely, that other studies are on the way to completion. Perhaps some will refute the sham vertebroplasty paper. Perhaps they will reinforce it. What is very clear is that vertebroplasty or kyphoplasty is now in the news and remains a very hot topic. And in the era that we live in of contracting healthcare dollars, in the absence of significant contrary evidence, will undoubtedly sit on someone's chopping block for reimbursement. I would, if nothing else, point to the references from the CBS Evening News alluded to in the lead editorial piece. Again, I think all the readership is directed to review those editorials and come to your own opinions. I would also encourage you to read the articles that they are based upon. The next article for review from the Fellows Journal Club Choices is a paper by Dinser et al. Entitled, Is All Communicating Hydrocephalus Really Communicating? Prospective study on the value of 3D constructive interference in steady state sequence at 3T. This is a very thought-provoking article which has changed many people's opinion about what communicating hydrocephalus really is. After reading this article, a number of the senior editors of the journal reported to have begun doing the KISS, CIS, or constructive interference in steady state sequence, or some equivalent sequence on other manufacturers' platforms in this patient cohort. And many are happy to report that it has worked as well as within this published article for them. That is, not uncommonly, one discovers a culprit for what has been called communicating hydrocephalus. The authors of this study used 3D KISS and phase contrast flow studies to image 134 patients who presented with large ventricles and no apparent cause for their hydrocephalus on conventional MR sequences. The KISS studies detected obstructing membranes in 20% of the patients who were later treated endoscopically instead of via ventricular peritoneal shunting. The author's conclusion is that this 3D KISS or CIS image, as well as a utilization of phase contrast flow studies in some patients, can document obstructing membranes, particularly in and around the fourth ventricle or in the fourth ventricle outlets and basal cisterns. Obviously, the detection of these membranes will affect patient management and prognosis. Those of you who are not performing a sequence in this fashion would be certainly recommended to review this article and see whether this is something you want to incorporate into your routine practice. Moving next to the editor's choices for the American Journal of Neuroradiology current issue, the first paper is by Appel et al., the Association of White Matter Hyperintensity Measurements on Brain MR Imaging with Cognitive Status, Medial Temporal Atrophy, and Cardiovascular Risk Factors. Patients who present with cognitive impairment and dementia, regardless of whether they may be diagnosed ultimately with Alzheimer's dementia, often have, largely as a reflection of their age, evidence of cerebrovascular disease. The features of cerebrovascular or cardiovascular-related brain changes may overlap somewhat with those of Alzheimer's patients. So, when you're reading an imaging study and you see white matter disease, what is the likely etiology of the white matter disease in this patient group? In this prospective study, the authors evaluated the presence and severity of white matter hyperintense lesions and mesial temporal atrophy in 192 patients broken down into groups, those with no cognitive impairment, mild cognitive impairment, and those with probable Alzheimer's disease. Cardiovascular or cerebrovascular risk factors were also calculated for all of their patients. Both abnormalities were more common in patients with probable Alzheimer's disease than in those who had no cognitive impairments. White matter changes, both in the periventricular white matter and the centrum semiovale, were definitively related to temporal atrophy, but not to cerebrovascular or cardiovascular risk factor. What do these results suggest? Well, they suggest that white matter changes in Alzheimer patients are probably related to neurodegeneration and not to any underlying cerebrovascular or cardiovascular condition. These white matter lesions are the reflection of the neurodegenerative state and not of a vascular pathology. The next paper in the editor's choices for the American Journal of Neuroradiology, paper by Curiata et al., Brain Structural Variability Due to Aging and Gender in Cognitively Healthy Elders, results from the Sao Paulo Aging and Health Study. This paper provides us with even more information on the aging brain. Some of this information may not be found to be particularly useful or flattering for men in the audience, however. These Brazilian investigators culled both morphometric and volumetric gray matter data from 132 patients who are enrolled in a long-term study in Brazil. They compared the data obtained for gray matter volumes to age with the purpose of identifying regional, location-specific, age-related volume alterations in elderly individuals. Their findings? It seems that we men, and these findings were not seen in any of the women in this cohort, men have accelerated gray matter losses in temporal prefrontal neocortex and in the mesial temporal cortex as well. Women, on the other hand, tended to show a more homogeneous pattern of gray matter volume loss. This predominant limbic involvement seen in the men in the study leaves certainly room for personal editorialization. The authors concluded that atrophy of these regions is, however, a part of the normal aging process. Again, this group is a cognitively healthy group of elderly patients. The next paper as an editor's choice for the American Journal of Neuroradiology by Bullitt et al., The Effect of Exercise on the Cerebral Vasculature of Healthy Aged Subjects as Visualized by MR Angiography. This is actually the feel-good paper for the journal for this month. Here's a little additional information that we all would certainly hope to find, that indeed exercise is good for you. There is some evidence that aerobic exercise may reduce brain atrophy and the white matter changes seen with advancing age. These investigators assessed differences in brain vasculature as visualized on MR angiography in patients with both high and low levels of physical activity. The arteries were segmented, their numbers counted, and their radii and the tortuosity of the individual vascular segments evaluated. Not surprisingly, to some, the authors found that aerobically active subjects have significantly fewer tortuous vessels and a larger number of smaller arteries. The inference here is that it is possible that exercise contributes to healthy brain aging. The authors do state, however, that it is unclear whether aerobic activity produces anatomic improvements in and of itself, or whether patients with younger appearing brains are more likely to engage in aerobic activity. In conclusion, here's to a younger appearing brain, and not just for us men. Thanks very much for listening, and we will return next month with more editor's choices from the American Journal of Neuroradiology and additional review of hot topics. It is our request that interested listeners to our podcast hit us up on the blog or email any of the editors with potential topics that you would be interested in hearing via podcast or special focus sessions. And if you have favorite articles that have appeared in recent times within the American Journal of Neuroradiology that you would like reviewed in a podcast format, questions to the author, or any other form, let us know. We'll be happy to listen to all requests. For the American Journal of Neuroradiology, I'm Doug Phillips. Thanks again for listening.